Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Unauthorized Disclosure Podcast. I'm Kevin Gastola, and I'm joined by Rania Kalik. And this week, we are welcoming Vincent Bevins, who is the author of The Jakarta Method, Washington's Anti-Communist Crusade, and the Mass Murder Program that Shaped Our World. He was the Brazil correspondent for the LA Times, and he was also the Southeast Asian correspondent, the Southeast Asia correspondent for the Washington Post. Welcome to the show, Vincent.
Yeah, thank you.
And so to begin, let's just outline what this is very basically. I don't want to presume that anybody knows who is tuning in to our show, what the Jakarta Method is. We're dealing with this history primarily that is Cold War era, going back to the 1960s predominantly. But why don't you outline what your fleshing out here in your book, The Jakarta Method.
Sure. So the book is about anti-communist mass murder programs. And so the apex of this story of 20th century violence unleashed against unarmed civilian leftists or accused leftists is in 1965 when the United States assists in the intentional extermination of approximately 1 million innocent civilians in Indonesia. And this 1965 massacre is one of the most important turning points of the Cold War. I argue that's probably the greatest victory for the side that is ultimately victorious. That is Washington and Washington's goals as they perceive them, and the construction of a global capitalist order led by Washington. And even though this event has been forgotten to a large extent since this massacre in Asia, 1965 to 66. It was very obvious at the time that this was a huge victory for the West and for anti-communism as an ideology. And so not only did you see left-wing groups around the world decide based on what they saw in Indonesia that they had to become more radical, that they had to take a defensive posture vis-a-vis Washington, you saw other right-wing movements, other allies of Washington or potential allies of Washington take inspiration from this program, either learn tactics directly or at least look to Indonesia and realize, oh, that's something that we can do and we can get away with it. So in the early 1970s in both Brazil and Chile, you see the deployment of the word Jakarta to signify the intentional mass murder of communists. So on the streets of Santiago de Chile under the government of Salvador Allende, you had a graffiti and sort of mailing terror campaign, which would send the message Jakarta is coming to supporters of Allende or employees in the government or members of leftist parties. And in Brazil, you had something behind the scenes whose nature is a little more mysterious, called something called Operação Jakarta, Operation Jakarta, which was also meant to signify the mass murder of leftists or accused leftists. And as I tell this story, which doesn't exactly start in Indonesia 1965, but it has that moment as its apex, it becomes clear looking at the entire Cold War that in at least 20 countries allied with the United States in the Cold War, the government or death squads or paramilitary forces carried out the intentional mass murder of leftists or perceived opponents to the construction of an authoritarian capitalist system that were called leftist, named leftist, in order to be justified, in order so that their murder could be justified. And I end up coming to the conclusion that this tactic, this method, this intentional extermination of leftists was such a fundamental part of the way that the United States won the Cold War that it ended up shaping the world that the Cold War created. And that's the world that we occupy now.
One thing I appreciate that you do as you're setting this all up before we start to dig into the extermination that happened on, which was backed by the United States, I appreciate that you center this or in the lead up, you cover the anti-colonial struggles that were going on. You position it as, if I'm understanding your book correctly, this is a direct response to this feeling that the U.S. is losing control of the world as all of these countries, especially in the global south, as we might call it, were rising up against these colonies that had been established.
Yeah, so the book starts in 1945, and I think it's really useful to lay out exactly what the world looks like at that point. And what you have is the United States not realizing that its hegemony is questioned, but realizing that it is the hegemon, that it is by far the most powerful country on the planet, probably the most powerful country ever to that point. And I like to outline the first, second, and third world division that became common in the Cold War, because I think it is actually useful, even though that third world term has been degraded a bit by racists using it in a derogatory term. But at the time, it was not a derogatory term whatsoever. At the time, you had the first world, which was the West, the former colonial powers in Western Europe, Japan, and the United States, which was the new white colonial power. Now, the United States was colonial in North America and had been colonial in Central America and in the Philippines. So it's important to recognize that everybody in the first world was an imperialist historically. And then you have the second world, which was the Soviet Union and its allies or the countries that the Red Army had quote unquote liberated and then occupied in Central Europe. And then you had the third world, which was the vast majority of humanity. And you don't want to paint the vast majority of humanity in broad brush, in too broad of strokes, but very simply, these were countries that had been under direct colonial control, Western European imperial control for hundreds of years, and they were either earning their independence for the first time or they were still in the process of earning their independence. And in some cases, the United States came back to explicitly help the Western colonial powers to reassert colonial control. This is what happened in France. And in other cases, you had the elaboration, articulation, and development of techniques, which I think we could call neocolonial, which is that the United States, whether this was its historical destiny or not, whether or not this was inevitable based on the personnel and political environment in Washington in 1945 to 1953 or so, the United States ended up exerting control over much of that third world in a way which I think is fair to call neocolonial, which is that there was not direct formal rule, but there was a set of rules under which you had to operate. And if you were to stray too far outside of the bounds of acceptability set by the hegemon in the United States, there was a very good chance that the United States would come in either covertly or overtly to try to change your government. Now, the first examples of this are Iran 1953 and then Guatemala 1954, when the CIA, freshly created after the end of World War II, for the first time succeeds and has its quote-unquote victories in carrying out regime change in what we would call the Global South. So I absolutely think that you have to situate what happens in Indonesia 1965 in the larger story of U.S. hegemony as it takes shape after World War II. And it's something that took shape very quickly and in sort of a haphazard manner. And I think there's a lot of ways you could point to what the United States did and what the CIA did and say that they were pretty clearly mistakes. They didn't know what they were doing. And they were kind of learning on the fly how to be a hegemonic power or an imperialist power, however you want to call it. And I think you have to situate that story of U.S. hegemony in the long history of Western European imperialism, whether the direct formal control that was exercised from Western Europe to the Global South, or the way that the United States itself became the nation that it is today, that is by the settlement of North America, the genocide of Native peoples, the constant expansion of North American borders, the branching out, as it were, into direct imperialism in the Philippines and in the Caribbean. So yeah, I think the story of 1965 and the story of the mass murder only makes sense if you situate it in this larger history, in this larger interaction between the global North and the global South.
And in Indonesia, you bring up 1965, can you kind of give some background and layout, like where the country is at that point? Who's Sukarno? Why is the Communist Party so widespread and popular across Indonesia?
Yeah, exactly. So Indonesia, although we've totally forgotten this again, is the fourth most populous country on earth. This is a hugely important country in the history of colonialism, the development of capitalism. And in the first years after World War II, it was one of the most important founding members, really, of this third world movement, which was this movement to get the formerly colonized peoples to take their place alongside the rich Western European countries. And this country, Indonesia, only called Indonesia, you know, after it got its independence from the Dutch, because really this is just 13,000, 15,000, 18,000 islands that were brought together by Dutch colonialism. Indonesia was really brought together under the leadership of a president named Sukarno. And Sukarno was a left-leaning, Marxist sympathetic, but never a communist, anti-imperialist independence leader that brought together all the disparate strands in Indonesian ideology to form some kind of an Indonesian-ness. And this Indonesian-ness from the very beginning was fiercely anti-colonial. He tried to bridge the gaps between the Indonesian Communist Party, which was very strong throughout the anti-colonial struggle, the Indonesian Muslim groups, which were also a fundamental part of this anti-colonial struggle, and the nationalist, more sort of moderate or centrist strands of anti-colonial thought. And this worked. So during the entire anti-colonial struggle, all these groups worked together. And when Indonesia eventually became a country and had its national ideology defined to a large extent by Sukarno himself, it was based around everybody, all these groups working together and forming part of a multi-party parliamentary democracy, which was stable but working. It existed in the 50s. Two things about this country convinced the officials back in Washington that Sukarno's project was no longer acceptable. Because in the very first early years of the Cold War, Sukarno was seen as somebody that Washington could deal with. But this changed in the middle of the 1950s for two reasons. Number one, the Indonesian Communist Party, which, as I said, was part of this sort of cooperative anti-colonial project called Indonesia, was doing better and better in elections. And so they were an unarmed party, a moderate party. They were the kind of communist party that believed that you had to work with capitalist forces, develop capitalism, and then much later transition to socialism. So they're very different than what we would think of as quote unquote communist in the English speaking world today. And throughout the 50s, they were doing better and better in elections. And this really alarmed Washington. The second thing that alarmed Washington is that Sukarno became a really explicit leader of this third world movement. He brought together about half the world's population at something called the Bandung Conference in 1955, or the Afro-Asian People's Conference in Indonesia. And this was an explicit challenge to U.S. hegemony, even though they tried to pose this in terms which would be acceptable to the United States. They tried to explicitly link this third world project to the United States' own anti-colonial struggle. They praised the legacy of Paul Revere at the Bandung Conference. They talked about the way that the United States had thrown off the British colonial yoke, and they didn't want to provoke Washington for understandable reasons. This is the most powerful country in history, and you don't want to pick a fight with them. But by the middle of the 1950s, the CIA especially, but the United States foreign policy establishment in general, has decided that Sukarno is a problem and the Indonesian left is a problem. And they unleash a set of various attempts to solve this problem. And at first they're all failures. But that's who Sukarno is. He is a neutral leader of a movement which wants to be neither aligned with the United States or the Soviet Union. He is sort of organically linked to all these disparate aspects of Indonesian culture and Indonesian politics. And he is a dyed-in-the-wool anti-imperialist, because his entire life, his entire political trajectory has been anti-colonialism.
And one thing that I think is worth quickly noting related to this conference you bring up is you emphasize that anti-communism wasn't something that was present in much of the third world. So in order for the conditions to really unfold, obviously military force is always going to be a huge factor in rendering something of that we're talking about successful. But you have to have people who believe in this ideology of anti-communism. And when Sukarno is there and when this conference is held, that doesn't really exist yet, right?
Yeah, absolutely. So I in the book, I do make a lot of comparisons between anti-communism here in the Western Hemisphere. I'm in Brazil now. So up and down the Western Hemisphere, it has historically been pretty easy to get elites to be violently anti-communist, because there's a thread in the history of all the Western Hemisphere settler colonies, which consists of being very afraid of rebellion from below, afraid of the black or brown people getting too much power and rising up and either, killing the slave owners or violently taking the land back from the feudal lords that were imposed by Western Europe. In Indonesia, in Southeast Asia in general, this just does not exist, right? So at the 1955 Bandung Conference, Richard Wright, who's an American author, he wrote Native Son. He's a great Black writer that was very influential in the middle of the 20th century. He goes to the Bandung Conference and he ends up speaking to leaders of Masyumi. Now, Masyumi is the conservative Muslim party that is receiving funding from the CIA. And he talks to them about Washington's attitude towards the Global South and Washington's attitudes towards communism. And even Masyumi, the CIA-backed Muslim party, tells him, like, look, we think that all they care about back in Washington is anti-communism, which is something that just doesn't gel with us. We don't trust that. They only like us because they think that we're the enemies of the communists. That is not the basis for a real friendship. And he doesn't go as far to say this, but Richard Wright realizes, and it's pretty clear to everyone at the time in Indonesia, the Communist Party is just another party, and they were a very important part of the reason that the Dutch were overthrown. There's no idea in Indonesia, in the 50s at least, that the Communist Party is some kind of an alien force that needs to be, that is being controlled by Moscow. This, you know, this makes no sense, especially as the Communist Party becomes the third largest party in the world, or the largest unarmed party in the world by the middle of the 1960s. They're not taking direction from Moscow. Everyone knows they're not. They're not taking direction from China. Everyone knows they're not. To a very large extent, you have to really import this fanatical anti-communism, which grows out of, I think, and this is my speculation, something about the settler colonial mindset in the Western Hemisphere. It just didn't, like I said, the first two attempts that the CIA has to bring down the Communist Party or to bring down Sukarno-led, left-leaning Indonesia in general just totally fail. So the first, you know, they give all this money to Masyumi, this party, and they still lose elections. The Indonesian Communist Party is doing better and better. And we know from CIA files that have been declassified and from comments that Richard Nixon made as vice president that the United States understood that the reason the Communist Party was doing so well was just because they were the best at outreach and organization. They were legitimately convincing people that they had their best interests at heart. And then in 1958, they tried to replicate the success of Iran and Guatemala. And they actually had U.S. pilots bombing the country in an attempt to break it up. And this also failed. The Indonesian military had enough legitimacy and the central government had enough power that and everybody just stuck behind Sukarno to the extent that this second attempt failed. And this was the largest CIA operation ever up until that point. But when they tried to do the things that had worked elsewhere, it just didn't work. And this is why in the end of the 1950s, they switched tactics. And I think a big part of making that leap that you rightly point to between a country which doesn't have a inherent anti-communist tradition to one that can ends up succeeding at demonizing communists is that they, instead of fighting the Indonesian military head on as they had in the 1958 bombing campaign, they started bringing thousands of officers to Kansas to be well taken care of and trained at the Leavenworth Army Base. And so from 1958 to 1965, you have the United States government really establishing ideological hegemony within the Indonesian armed forces. And this is what makes possible the ultimate catastrophe of 1965.
And can you explain how that went down, as I guess briefly as you can?
Sure, yeah. From this, in this period from 1958 to 1965, there was the return to this uneasy idea that maybe Sukarno could be tolerated. In 1963-64, they abandon this and they bring in a new ambassador who's obviously meant to oversee a regime change in Indonesia. And we don't know exactly what they're doing behind the scenes in 1964 and 1965, but we know that MI6 and CIA said that they would be agitating to create a clash between the unarmed Communist Party and the very well-armed military, understanding very well that when an unarmed group clashes with an armed group, the armed group wins. And we still don't know exactly how this happened in September and October 1965, but this clash does happen. And when this clash does happen, it is used as a pretext to spread propaganda, intentionally misleading propaganda about the Indonesian Communist Party, to blame them for violence that is taking place, and to begin to crush the party by arresting and executing them en masse. And as soon as this starts from the very beginning, as soon as this clash has been does appear, the United States embassy participates enthusiastically in the decimation of the Communist Party, encouraging, you know, supplying material support when needed, but not that much was needed, encouraging the Indonesian military to continue to crush the left, knowing very well what that meant at the time, and handing over lists of specific individuals that were communists and therefore needed to be killed. And by the beginning of 1966, approximately 1 million people are dead. 1 million more people are still in concentration camps solely for their political beliefs. And Indonesia flips from a country that is led by Sukarno, a loudly and proudly anti-imperialist left-leaning president, to General Suharto, a US-backed dictator, who is welcomed with open arms into the club of most favored nations, into the quote-unquote free world. He becomes the United States, one of the most important US allies in the Cold War in Asia. And whatever he does after this is basically unquestioned. And this includes the 1975 invasion of East Timor, which ends up killing approximately one third of that country. He justifies the invasion on anti-communist grounds. The United States, led by Gerald Ford and Jimmy Carter, don't have any problem with this. He's too important of an ally. And this is, as I said, one of the most important turning points in the Cold War. This is a far more important country than Vietnam was. And everybody that was paying attention at the time realized how important of a victory this was for the West.
And as you detail in the book, I mean, we'll go back. There's some things related to this particular moment, which you explore under the chapter headline of extermination. But in the aftermath, what's important is that U.S. businesses are able to get into Indonesia and have, I'd say, unprecedented opportunities to expand their corporations and what they're doing around the world globally.
Yep, absolutely. So during the extermination of leftists and accused leftists, the U.S. government is, while very unconcerned about what's happening, any human rights violations or, you know, a massacre, they're very concerned about making sure that the nascent Suharto government makes sure that oil opportunities are, that remain open to U.S. corporations. And Suharto understands very clearly that he has to make sure this happens, and it does. And when he consolidates his rule, you have U.S. corporations pouring into Jakarta for swanky conferences in which they celebrate this victory for capitalism in the free world and for business. And Suharto becomes quickly integrated into the global capitalist system. And there is a explicit celebration of these opportunities that are opened up for Western corporations.
And how did this play out? Like, what were the consequences after this took place for other countries who in the third world who were watching? How did it change their dynamic?
Yeah, so as I said at the beginning, like, there's two very different things happened depending on which side of the aisle you were on. So left-wing groups around the world were really paying attention in Indonesia because this was the largest unarmed communist party, probably the largest unarmed leftist party in history. And when overnight the largest unarmed leftist party in history is stabbed and thrown into rivers and nobody cares and they get away with it and they're just decimated over the course of 6 months, a lot of other leftists around the world come to the conclusion that there is no peaceful path to socialism, that the Western imperialist powers will come for you and you have to be ready. And this is a conclusion that Che Guevara already came to in 1954 after watching the Guatemala coup. But the ripples that emanate out from the 1965 on the left side of the political spectrum affect countries like Cambodia. So Pol Pot says, in discussions at the time, uses the Indonesia example to come to the conclusion that you cannot be in collaboration with any other forces. You have to be, you know, violently self-defensive. And we all know how catastrophic the consequences of that shift were. the death of the Communist Party in Indonesia becomes a major part of the Cultural Revolution in China. We don't know to what extent it caused the Cultural Revolution, but certainly was became incorporated into the Cultural Revolution. For this book, I interviewed the founding member of the Communist Party of the Philippines, who's still active. He said that the reason that the Communist Party of the Philippines became an armed party was because he was watching what happened in Indonesia. And then also in Latin America, you had discussions up and down Central and South America as to what this meant. Do we have to take lessons from this, or does this not apply to us? And for example, in Chile, which I go into in the book, the side which ultimately says, we don't need to worry about this, Chile's different, we're a more peaceful, sophisticated country, they win the argument, and Salvador Allende clearly takes the peaceful democratic path to socialism, thinking that things will be okay for him there. Now, on the right side of the spectrum, politically, you get the very opposite happen. You get people explicitly copying tactics. So now I believe at least personally, that the first time that mass disappearances happened in Asia is probably 1965, 1966. The first time that it happened in Latin America is Guatemala in 1966. And there are people that were moved from the relevant stations in Southeast Asia to Guatemala at the exact same time. So it's entirely plausible that disappearances in Latin America were a copy of a tactic that was used in mass in Asia for the first time in 1965, 1966. And then, as I mentioned earlier, in Chile, as this democratic socialist wins power, the use of Jakarta is deployed to terrify the supporters of that government to say, we're going to kill you. So as they would write, Jakarta is coming on the streets of Santiago, and or send postcards to people's houses saying, Jakarta is coming. The lesson, the very obvious message to anyone that was paying attention to the Cold War at the time, and these people were, was, we're going to kill you, like they did in Indonesia. And we don't know to what extent this was, to who exactly told them to do this. I have a good idea, but it's partially speculative. But we do know that anybody that was paying attention to world politics from 1965 to 1971, 2, 3, would have come to the conclusion watching Indonesia that, oh, if you kill as many of the opponents to a US-backed capitalist regime as you feel you need to, and then you blame all of that on anti-communism, you're going to get away with it. Not only are you going to get away with it, the United States is going to welcome you with open arms and run defense for you on the global stage, saying that you did what was necessary, that actually you're a good country.
So I'd like you to take a moment to bring in some of the other components that make this effective. I mean, obviously, there's much more going on than just supporting military forces in Indonesia or backing them covertly in order to make sure that there's success. And so could you get into the economic warfare element? We've got the IMF is involved in the structural adjustment program, or involved in establishing ways of managing Indonesia. Well, why don't you dig into that first?
Yeah, sure. So I think for a lot of people, especially Americans or people in the West in general, have a hard time understanding how it is that the U.S. would end up backing the intentional mass murder of a million people in Indonesia. And I think it's important not only to be fair, but to make this easier to sort of comprehend, that this was not the first attempt, right? This is not what they go for right away. And over those early years of the Cold War, they developed a set of a kind of playbook and an array of options that they could use to destabilize a country in the service of regime change. And in countries like Guatemala and Iran and Brazil, they did not have to come to, it never came to this kind of a mass murder program to end up destabilizing the country. And part of the reason for that is because these other destabilization techniques, which include ruining the economy, either by making it impossible for the country to access international capital, or sometimes more explicit sort of boycotting, like sanctions and things, are very effective, right? So in Brazil, 1964, for example, the government of Jango Goulart was trying to carry out land reform, which horrified the Brazilian elites, and also trying to give the vote to everyone in the country, and that included the black and brown people that had been disenfranchised by voting laws. Now, in Brazil, the coup was carried out quite easily. The U.S. offered military assistance to the Brazilian military, but they didn't need it. And the reason they didn't need it is because in the run-up to the coup, things like the destabilization of the economy was so effective. And by 1964, a large part of the middle classes, and most importantly, the economic and political elites were behind regime change. And so I think it's important to understand this Jakarta method, or the, you know, in the ultimate case, the intentional extermination of real or perceived enemies, as one of many tools in a very large toolbox that can be used to smash countries back in line when they get too far out of the bounds of what is dictated by U.S. hegemony, or just to be smashed. You know, if they can't be smashed back in, just being smashed is enough. And at the very least, that will solve the problem of having a powerful opponent to this order. So yes, all kinds of destabilization, economic destabilization techniques are used in the service of regime change, for sure. And in Indonesia, definitely the economy was really bad by 1964-65. And part of this was Sukarno's fault. Part of this was international conditions. But that wasn't going to be enough there. The Indonesian Communist Party was so big. There's 25-30% of the country was either in the party or somehow affiliated with the party. Just having the economy be a mess was not going to lead to the desired outcome. But as a rule, that's one of the first things they go for, is using economic destabilization.
I'm curious how, you know, when you were like researching and writing this book, if you saw parallels to today. Because obviously, like, we're not in the same Cold War situation that existed back then, but the U.S. is the most powerful country in the world and continues to use methods to overthrow governments it doesn't like. Whether those governments are good or bad doesn't matter. It's not so much about communism anymore. But that said, a lot of these same methods are used, especially when it comes to the economic method. I mean, a country always gets softened up for you know, regime change with sanctions, whether it's with Iran or Syria or Venezuela right now, or with Iraq, you know, back through the 90s. But the same, I mean, sanctions seem to play an even bigger role of what could be described, I think, as like medieval sieges now. You don't see so much of like the CIA, you know, funding like mass extermination. But, you know, there is still this role, particularly that the State Department plays. You also have, you know, these global financial institutions still play a role. So, like, I mean, writing this book, when you look at today and what the U.S. does in the global South, what are the parallels that you see?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I think that the global situation changes at the end of the Cold War. Sort of geopolitical space-time is different. But this toolbox that has been developed from 1945 to 1990, they don't throw it away, right? I mean, they've invested a lot of time and energy in learning the best ways to nudge countries onto the path that they believe is best. And they held on to these techniques. And I think it's important to be aware of the possible the ways in which current events draw upon or resonate with the 20th century, because the toolbox is still there. Now, I absolutely think that I think that having a good understanding of the way that the United States exercised its hegemony in the 20th century is essential to understand it's like the most basic requirement for understanding the way the U.S. hegemony operates in the 21st century. I think it's the bare minimum. I think that there's probably limits to how much you can project from the past into the future. But if you're not aware of how we got here, how this global system was shaped in the first place, the toolbox that was used, the toolbox which remains, the almost intrinsic or deeply foundational nature of some of these U.S. institutions, which remain the same and remain very active on the global stage. Without understanding all of that, you're going to have a very hard time understanding what's going on right now. And I think you're also right to point out that you don't see the exact same thing happen. And I think one of the things that I try to point out over the book is that they not only developed a set of tools, they sort of refined them throughout the Cold War. They kind of got better at this as they went along. And I think if you look at 1953, Iran, Guatemala, 1954, or the selection of the leaders of South Korea and the leaders of South Vietnam, both Christians who had absolutely no, very little legitimacy amongst the people they were meant to rule. You can view this period as sort of a young empire or a young hegemon making a lot of mistakes and then realizing that this is the wrong way to do it. So as the 50s turn into the 60s, you see them moving away from these very obvious and sort of ham-fisted and clumsy techniques that everybody could see. You know, everyone in Iran and Guatemala knew exactly what had happened to the country, to more subtle and ultimately effective in the long term techniques of winning hegemony amongst local elites, as they did in Brazil, making sure that there is no possibility for opposition, as they do in Indonesia. And then as you can move into the 60s, 70s, and 80s, you see a larger, more subtle and sometimes more effective range of tactics developed. And I think that's a situation we find ourselves in. Not only, though, is U.S. hegemony weaker, which I think is important to understand. It's weaker, but it's had a lot longer to develop a range of ways to interact with perceived enemies around the world.
Well, I think, I want to go back to something you mentioned, but we didn't dig into yet. You mentioned that there were officers that were brought to the United States and they were able to study at Leavenworth in Kansas. One of the people who you mentioned in the book is Ishak Juwarsa, who comes up with this phrase of down to the roots, and it becomes a public refrain for the mass murder program that is carried out. And you detail this, or you highlight this in the book. And I bring this up in the context of where we are now in this conversation, because it seems like Indonesia is maybe one of these, you can tell me if I'm wrong, it seems like it's a crucial development, because the U.S. continues to train military officers to bring them to the United States. They go back to their countries, taking the whatever they have learned in institutions in the United States. We've seen that particularly in Latin America with the School of the Americas, which is now known as WINSEC. And so it seems like that tactic is also a part of this toolbox that we're describing.
Yeah, and I don't think anyone would deny that, right? I mean, I think this is one of the, and there is a way to view these tools as benevolent, right? And that's the way that the U.S. military would describe them, right? They would say, oh yeah, of course we form alliances with other militaries around the world, and we train them, and we offer assistance, and we're very proud of doing this. And it in the case of Indonesia in the 60s, and certainly the School of the Americas later in what happened in Central America, you could see this leading to horrible outcomes, right? But I don't think the United States even itself they don't deny this kind of cooperation between militaries. Now the question is, and this is where it gets really hard, I mean, where and when do you view this as an inherently malevolent, or where do you say, okay, well, yeah, it makes sense to have military training. The most powerful country in the world is trading tips with these other countries. And that's why I think it's important to pay very close attention to what the real interests of the U.S. or any country are when they interact with another. And I think history, at the very least, this is an understatement problem, at the very least leads us to the conclusion that you can't always trust what they say the interest is. It's when we're dealing with major states with obvious interests, it's best to look into the historical and material explanations that might arise for any kind of given military to military cooperation.
You mentioned earlier that like in passing, that you feel American hegemony is weaker today than it was back then? What makes you say that? I'm curious.
I think it's relatively weaker, right? So I think it's really important to understand that we're still the most powerful country in the world, militarily, economically, not even close. China is catching up relatively. But I mean, that's largely as a result of the fact that they have so many people, right? I mean, GDP per capita in China is 1/6 of GDP in the United States. Standard of living in the United States is far ahead of China, and militarily, they're far behind. But I think it's undeniable that we are weaker than we were in, say, 1990. That the force of gravity, you know, some parts of the global south catching up to us, and that's often China, is responsible for that. A country which I think it's notable that they exist outside of sort of the sphere of the US-led global system that was created in the Cold War. They caught up on a very different path. Who knows if we like that path or not, but it is very different than the ones that were handed, that the other countries in the global south were forced upon. But things like the slow rise of China, the disaster of the war in Iraq, Trump, Donald Trump being a disaster for US soft power, but also explicitly neglecting the alliance which undergird the system that he inherited. I think we're it's pretty clear we're less, our hegemony is less unchecked than it was in 1990. 1990 was a really insanely unipolar moment by the standards of world history, right? Like, it's not normal that one country really is in charge. So I think it's a relative decline, and I think that's probably an important reason. That's why this is an important moment to look at where this hegemony came from, to realize that it hasn't been around that long. It's about 70 years, the US-led global order. The idea that a Western European settler colony in North America would have unchecked influence on the majority of the planet, you can see how it happened, but you can see how it's not the only way that that a planet can be organized. And as we move to something else, I don't think it's going to be tomorrow, but in the next 20 years, 50 years, I think we're going to have to be very, very seriously. We have to put aside our illusions about what this hegemony was, because although it might have been very nice for the last 70 years to believe that it was because the whole country, the world loved American movies and the kind of liberty that we gave them or whatever. As that's not what everybody else thinks, and that's not what everybody else knows is behind this. And as we slowly slowly slide into a world in which we are less hegemonic and must be, I'm not even making the moral case, but just the forces of geopolitical gravity are making some kind of a transition necessary. I think this is why it's the right moment to look at sort of how we got here. In my book, this wasn't really my intention. It's more something I stumbled upon. It was a place that I was sent. It was a story that I found because of just my own personal linguistic and journalistic background. Ends up being the worst part of that story, the absolute darkest corner of that hegemonic order taking shape. But I think it's really time to look at the whole thing.
And as we the last thing I have for you as we wrap is I just want to bring in the issue of media, because as you make very clear in your book, after these massacres happened, after you have Suharto now in control, there's wholehearted support from elites in the United States. There's way it's covered by the US press. And so you have that dynamic, but then there's also the way in which you've got media, state media institutions that are brought to bear on the population in Indonesia, the Voice of America, BBC, Radio Australia broadcasts, all pumping propaganda about the PKI into Indonesia. So I just wanted to make sure in our widespread conversation here that we didn't ignore this media issue and how it's fundamentally been able to shape people's perceptions and allow for this Jakarta method to be successful.
Yeah, and I go into this in the book, and I'm very, I think we have to take a really hard look at what that meant and what it could mean now. I mean, my entire career has been in mainstream English language journalism, and you know, and that's where I want to stay. And I think there's value in that enterprise, but we have to be very, you know, honest about the ways in which that those institutions were deployed in the 20th century and sort of what that might lead us to believe about them now. So not only in Guatemala, but in Indonesia, we saw the explicit collaboration between public and private media and U.S.-led regime change operations. So in 1954 in Guatemala, the New York Times had a reporter that knew what was going on and was going to report on what was going on in the run-up to the CIA-backed coup there. And the CIA asked the New York Times to call that reporter back, and they did. And then in 1965, as this clash is generated that I discussed earlier, this clash between the Communist Party, or between the left and the right, even though who knows if the Communist Party was even involved at all, you have the CIA helping to spread this propaganda, and then Western media outlets helping and explicitly helping and knowing they were helping. So this includes BBC, Radio Australia, Voice of America. I mean, the New York Times, eventually when the Suharto coup is eventually consolidated after this mass murder, they celebrate what has happened. They blame Indonesians themselves for the violence. They blame in a very racist way, say that this is something that these Malay people do to each other. They're just murderous. And historians of sort of US media that know this a lot better than me point me in the direction to say that from 1945 to 1975, the CIA was kind of seen as like troop. Like if they asked you for something, then it was sort of your patriotic duty to do it, and a lot of the media would do it. Now, after the Church Commission in 1975, this leads to the era of sort of scary stories about the CIA or the you know, the proliferation of conspiracy theories in the United States that I think we're all sort of familiar from the second half of the 20th century. Because when people find out what the CIA had been doing, people become very suspicious about what the government does abroad. And in the, you know, the last 25 years of the 20th century, the CIA is no longer seen as something that if they come to you at the Washington Post and ask you for their help, they're automatically going to give it. Now, so you see more stories and exposés in the major media about sort of death squads in Central America and violations carried out by our allies around the world. However, does that stop them, right? If you're a Guatemalan or an El Salvadoran, is it better for you that a small expose comes out in the Washington Post and then the Reagan administration denies it vehemently and then the media sort of offers a both sides take and then the death squads continue to kill you and your family, right? And from a really like, if you take a really huge lens and step back and look at this world historically, that like shift in posture that the US media takes after the Church Commission doesn't really stop or change. It doesn't change the shape of the exercise of U.S. hegemony around the world. And I think it's just good to recognize that U.S. media are U.S. media. They exist as every other institution in human history has. They exist. They exist within history. They have a role. They have institutional. They are embedded within institutions and cultural norms and practices, and Americans sort of intrinsically believe certain things about the nature of their government, and this gets reproduced in newsrooms. And but yeah, I do not want people to read. I don't want people to throw away the kinds of outlets that I work for, but I don't want people to view them as outside of history. I want them to be viewed as what they are: institutions that evolved from these events that I outline in the book.
I think it's also really interesting too, because if you look at the way that the U.S. government has sort of shifted tactic, maybe not the whole just institution of pushing U.S. government talking points, it doesn't necessarily come from it doesn't actually come from the CIA today. It actually comes in a different way, where you have like a number of think tanks that have experts at them, but then these think tanks are often funded by like weapons companies get a little bit of funding from the State Department. And they're the ones that are sort of reproducing narratives. And then those people end up getting turned to by the media as experts on various countries. And then that's oftentimes, I think, you know, that's maybe a little bit simplistic, but it's interesting when you talk about like refining, because I think that's what one way where things have been refined, where you still get those talking points in the mainstream, but it's not necessarily coming directly from the US government. It's coming from people who are perceived as experts with some sort of authority. And then that actually like have an agenda behind them.
Yeah. And you know, one thing that I could say in my whatever 10, 15 years working in international journalism for like sort of the bigger English language outlets is that budgets have been slashed, especially for international reporting. You have more and more freelancers getting paid less and less and being asked to produce more and more on a shorter deadline. And in this situation, you need somebody that can supply analysis and commentary quickly. And in this situation, the very well-funded organizations that exist right next to you that are always ready to talk to you become very important, relatively more important for your reporting. So it becomes a lot easier to call a think tank. They might be fund, you know, everyone's funded by somebody, right? So
right. Nobody,
everyone, you know, as a reporter, you have to understand that everybody has institutional positioning, right? In an ideal world, you would listen to these think tanks, you would listen to the US government, but then you would also go out and do the reporting to find out every way that you might be able to contradict these accounts or listen to other sides of the story. And I think the economic environment for journalism has made this more and more difficult. And that makes sort of these very well-funded PR operations, whether at corporations or whether at governments or whether at government-funded or corporation-funded institutions, much more important. And this is something Chomsky points to even back in the 70s with manufacturing consent, is that, you know, you reporters need, and this is not something that is a necessarily a radical point, I think it's just a nuts and bolts analysis of media, that you need information, you know, and a reporter relies upon other people to tell them what's going on. And in 2020, a lot of people rely on these hugely powerful and well-funded institutions to tell them what's going on, because we have less and less time to go out there and figure it out what the other side of the story is.
Well, I think we need to start wrapping, but I thought I'd end on maybe sort of a lighter note. But you know, you mentioned that there's a whole lot of people who, in the latter part of the 20th century, believe these conspiracy theories that the CIA is behind these things. And there's something, I can't leave this untouched, there's something that comes off bizarre in your book that you mentioned about the CIA hiring these porn actors to do a film in order to play off of the extramarital affairs that Sukarno was having in Indonesia. And I think this is a nice way to conclude our broadcast, because it just sort of illustrates the lengths to which you know, an agency might go in order to advance its agenda. But could you just very briefly say what this was and how it failed?
Yeah, so this was part of the toolbox, the tools deployed against Sukarno in the late 50s. So one of the things they came up with is they authorized his assassination and found out who the person that might assassinate him. They didn't go forward with that. They were, as I said, paying right-wing Muslim parties in the country. They also came up with, we might term in the language sort of Russiagate, as like a old school compromat tape sort of scenario, right? So the plan was to make a tape that would show, allegedly, that Sukarno had slept with a white, blonde, Russian KGB agent, and therefore was not only morally compromised as a person, but compromised politically, because the KGB had control over him, and he was in the back pocket of the Russians because he had slept with a KGB agent, and now they controlled him. So in order to make this story fly, they went to Hollywood, where they had lots of connections, And this connection was supplied or involved a man that worked for Howard Hughes, but Howard Hughes wasn't involved. The person that actually made the film was Bing Crosby and his brother Larry. They had a production company. And stories vary a little bit on the details, but it's the best picture we have is that they hired porn actors who were not going to sort of engage in full sex on tape. They were going to, it was going to be very suggestive because it was supposed to be like the kind of a film that would have been taken from a hidden camera in a hotel. It wasn't going to be like a porn. And they got what was apparently a Mexican-American actor in LA that they thought they could make look like Sukarno, kind of, with wig, with hair and makeup, and a blonde woman. And they filmed this, apparently. To the best of our knowledge, the tape was filmed, but it was not released, not because they realized that the United States government should not be in the business of destroying the reputation of the founding father of a young nation, but because the film was not convincing, and they realized this could blow up in
their
face.
At least I didn't use brown face.
I'm pretty sure that something like that would have been exactly what they did. They found like the most ethnic guy they could find, and then they tried to make him look more.
Oh, shit.
Yeah. I mean, I think it would have been, yeah, problematic. And
sounds like a great basis for a movie.
Yeah, no, this is like, I like, because I had these, I'd seen these secondhand reports, like kind of distributed everywhere. So I went to really look at all the people that were affirming that this happened, and like all the people with the most intimate knowledge of CIA activities at the time, and this guy that worked for Howard Hughes, they were like, yeah. At the very least, they would deny some aspect of the film, but it sounds like it really happened. Yeah, so like another way to like, bring back the legacy of Bing Crosby and on the silver screen to have, you know, make a movie about him helping the CIA to destroy the reputation of one of the most inspirational men in the global South. Yeah.
It's the like, anti-white Christmas.
Exactly. Yeah.
Exactly. All right. Well, thank you, Vincent. We really appreciate you joining us to have this discussion. Again, for people, the book is called The Jakarta Method, Washington's Anti-Communist Crusade and the Mass Murder Program That Shaped Our World. It's available, I imagine, from just about any bookstore that you would go to. I don't know, is there a particular way you want them to purchase it? Or
It's sold out right now. So my website, just thejakartamethod.com, I try to keep up, like, I try to, like, put updates on where it's, like, available and what the best way to buy it is. And, like, and I outline where he's there that you can like avoid Amazon or support independent booksellers. So if you can, buy wherever you want, but if you want to check out thejakartamethod.com, I usually have some pointers as to what's going on.
Well, thank you very much for joining us. We really appreciate the book, and stay safe in Brazil, right? You're in Brazil right now.
Yeah, probably, but perhaps not infected with the coronavirus and trying to figure out a way if I'm allowed to leave. I think the Bolsonaro banned flights from here to the United States, so I'll try to figure that out soon. Trump actually was the one to do it. But yeah, thanks for that.
You're trailing us. You're trailing us.
Yeah, we're catching up. No, Brazil's catching up, I think. I think Brazil might catch up with the United States. It's
No, man, we're number one. Don't even.
Yeah, you are. Number one, USA. USA.
Because we have Texas and Florida that you'll never be able to catch us.
No, it's true. Yeah, the Amazon holds back Brazil because it's not populated enough to really for the virus to really spread. So,
well, Arizona,
USA still number one. Like USA, you know, it's a superpower to this day.
Take pride in it. Well, thank you so much. Stay safe, stay healthy, and we'll be back next week. Oh, go ahead, Kevin. You had one more.
Well, time. I was just going to do our sign off for our listeners and our viewers and just say thank you for watching, and we'll be back next week with another episode.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you to all of our patrons for making this show possible on a weekly basis. If you're able to support the show, we encourage you to go to patreon.com/unauthorizeddisclosure, patreon.com/unauthorizeddisclosure. There you'll get early access to episodes and access to exclusive content.
Thank you.